Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Yesterday, Oklahoman Joy Harjo was named as the United States' 23rd Poet Laureate by the Library of Congress. Harjo, a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, will be the first Native American and the first Oklahoman to serve in this position. Harjo is the author of 8 collections of poetry, a memoir, and is also a talented musician. Her entire body of work is informed by Indian culture, language, and stories, both the traditional ones as well as contemporary ones that reflect on being Indian today. I spoke with Joy Harjo back in 2012 when she wrote her memoir, Crazy Brave. It was a story of her youth growing up in Tulsa, living in a family affected by alcoholism and abuse from a step-parent. It's also a story of how she found poetry and how that discovery changed her life. Harjo's life certainly will change when she becomes the 23rd Poet Laureate this fall at the Library of Congress. Today we repeat our 2012 conversation with her on Studio Tulsa. Joy Harjo, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Your book, Crazy Brave, it's a beautiful memoir, and there's a lot of poetry in the prose, which is the first thing. The very first story is it's almost like your own creation story. It's a story of telling in a very metaphoric way of how you came to be. Tell us a little about the origins of deciding to write about your life. Is this something you've been wanting to do for a long time?
Yes and no. I was conflicted about it because I didn't want to really write about myself, but a memoir was interesting to me because a memoir is about memory, and I figured it was about time, you know, to put some of those in place. And I got the contract about 14 years ago.
I saw in your acknowledgments you say you thank your editor for her long-running patience. So this must have been if not a project by starts and stops, it must have been, it's been long and drawn out to write this story.
Yes, it was starts and stops because of my own resistance and then thinking, well, how am I going to do this? And then I started it. It had about 3 different forms. The first one was called, I was going to call it A Love Supreme, of course, referencing John Coltrane. And it was going to be in vignettes with musical vignettes. And then I found out how much it costs to use to reference music. And they usually make the authors pay for anything like that. Right. And that would have probably cost all of my little advance. So I, of course, I write my own songs, so I could do it that way. But I needed the larger references. And then I decided to write it as a short stories of stories that would take place in going to Indian school, because I left Tulsa when I went to 1 year of Real Rogers, and then I left to go to Indian boarding school, and that saved my life. So I was going to put the stories around, write short stories around that and around being a teenage mother, and I came back and wound up being a teenage mother in Tahlequah and here in Tulsa, and it was really rugged. And so I got about 4 stories in and realized that that was not going to work, at least the spirit of the book had something else in mind. And so then I spent the rest of the time fighting against it because I did not want to write about childhood.
Well, it was a tough childhood. It really was. And I think what you devised with the metaphor of the directions and the metaphors of a lot of your upbringing and the idea of east, north, west, south, east is the beginning. You use these as sort of stories. And again, I mentioned the birth story, which was, it was almost like you're telling the story through metaphor of how your life began, your early years. You mentioned your mother and father and relate them to fire and water. Can you explain that? What does that mean?
Yes, I think that everybody, you know, we all have different elements that we vibe with, and people sometimes are more fire. Like I have a son who's...
And you're fire. You think yourself as a mixture of fire and water.
Yeah, I mean, we're all earth. I have 2 paragraphs here.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, my mother-to-be was fire. Those of fire move about the earth with inspiration and purpose. They are creative and can consume and be consumed by their desires. They are looking for purpose, a place in which to create. They can be so entranced with the excitement of creation that their dreams burn up, turn to ashes. My father-to-be was of the water and could not find a hold on the banks of earthiness. Water people can easily get lost, and they may not comprehend that they are lost. They succumb easily to the spirits of alcohol and drugs. They will always search for a vision that cannot be found on earth.
Let me ask you about searching for a vision, because there are lots of visions in this book.
Uh-huh.
Is that something that's always been a part of you?
Yes, that's been a part. Maybe this whole life is a strange and difficult vision, you know, but it has been since I was, you know, before anybody you call it that. It's just been an integrated part, you know, dreams and dreams that are in dream time and outside of it. That's just always been an integrated part of my life. I think it is with everyone's, but we've been educated otherwise.
You know, there's an interesting story that you tell in it about a door closing and then a door reopening. And one of the saddest parts of the book is when the door closes, and this idea that you were open to this as a child and you were seeing these visions, the only really way to describe it. And then at one point, I can't remember if it was church or it was something your stepfather said, that door slammed shut for a long time. As
yes.
You were growing up, and somehow you were able to reopen it.
Yeah, I think it happens to a lot of people. I mean, if you look at artists and statements of artists, most artists are trying to get back to that place where, you know, we were open.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it in children. I mean, I've gone in and talked and performed in schools and gone to school events for children and grandchildren, and you see the kindergartners come in and they're just shining, the light shines through their eyes, and then you see them in that system and they become a lot more guarded.
There's an interesting story you told about being in kindergarten, and you were drawing very freely, and you looked over at all your schoolmates, and they were all drawing the same house, little with a tree and the chimney and the smoke coming out, and you said, why are you all drawing the same picture?
Yeah.
And I think that's a great description of that sort of idea of having your own personal path. And I think it's drummed out pretty early.
It is. I mean, you get the message immediately that, you know, if you do not draw the sun the same way or the little house or color your ghost white.
Yeah, that was another story about making your ghost green.
Yeah, you know, I had a whole little posse around my desk in first grade in Burbank Elementary School for kids upset that I had colored my ghost green. And I said, and I was extremely shy, so I wasn't loud when I said this, but I'm sitting there thinking I'm going to get lynched because they were really upset. And they were waiting for me to get in trouble by the teacher because I had done something wrong. And then I said, but have you ever seen a ghost? And ghosts can be green. And I was aware then in both those instances that there was a prescribed way to see the world and to understand the world. And I was already aware that I didn't fit and that I would never quite fit.
You've had an on and off relationship with the church, which you write about in there, and it was very poignant what you wrote. What attracts you to the church and what repels you?
Well, I don't belong to any organized religion.
Yeah. Today, but as you were growing up, this was something you I think instinctively
yes.
longed for.
I think that we all have a relationship with God or we wouldn't be here. I think that God lives within every one of us. And I believe that we were all put here by a God who loves us, not a God who's looking for retribution or to send us to hell or to, you know, make us go by rules that were made by men who wanted to control people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I was standing outside. You know, my mother took us to church, and I liked singing, and I liked thinking about, you know, the sacred. But even as a child, and that's in the book too, even at, you know, really young age, I would go outside before everyone, and that's where I saw God. I saw God in the sun and that light that comes from the sun and the beauty of the flowers and the earth and the creatures and all of the creatures made by that creator who is really outside any kind of religion, even though religions try to encapsulate or express. And they give people a way to come together to express. You know, I think at their highest purpose, give people a way to express you know, the love. But at the worst is the fundamentalism that really made me was part of my flight from this part of the world.
Yeah. You document the story of your mother and father, and your biological father was, it seemed like at one point a wonderful man, but he did drink and mm-hmm. he abused the family, but not, you know, I mean, I gather there's some ambiguity in how you view him. And your stepfather, which you relate later, not a pretty picture at all.
Well, my father wasn't malicious. I think that's the difference, is that we knew that he loved us, but we also knew that he was struggling. And, you know, yes, he did go off into, you know, it was hard being a Native man in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the 50s. I think it still is. I don't think a lot of that's changed, you know, to be. And to be a man, and you know, we were sent here, and then here the lands were taken over by oil interests, etc.
Yeah.
And so it was difficult, and I think that he just, you know, and he was somebody who was extremely sensitive. I think he also was visionary of sorts, and he didn't know, you know, I mean, he had to be a man of this society, and he did the best he could.
You think he was an artist in some way?
I mean, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps not as much as your mother. Mother was a singer and wrote songs and actually sang with Leon McAuliffe one point.
Yes, she did.
Which got her into a lot of trouble with your stepfather. And that is one of the sad, I have to tell you, that is one of the saddest parts of the book. It's the story of your mother, the day he basically forbade her to sing. And you said their house was full of songs. You always listened to the radio. You always sang along. And then this new man comes in who's apparently the worst kind of control freak and emotional abuser,
yeah,
as well as physical abuser. And he says, don't sing, ever. To me, that was the saddest thing in the whole entire book. And there were many sad parts as well as happy parts.
Well, I walked away from music because it was around that time I was playing clarinet, and I went to junior high, we called it Cleveland Junior High, yeah. And the band teacher wouldn't let me play sax because I was a girl. And that happened, I realized, when I was writing the book, I realized, and I never put those two events together, that I was also forbidden to sing at home around the same time, and that's when I walked away from music and then came back to it. I mean, it had been taken away from my mother in that instance where she got to sing at this event with Leon McAuliffe.
That was the one time.
And then, you know, he
basically abused her all the way home, basically telling her it was no good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's terrible. My guest today is Joy Harjo, musician, poet, writer, artist, really, visual artist as well. And her book, Crazy Brave, is published by Norton. The book is, again, you mentioned all these struggles to get this book down, and it's a bit of an amalgam in many ways. I mean, you tell a rabbit story at the beginning to mm-hmm. talk about the clay man who didn't have ears. You do have one of those, I assume it's one of those short stories that you're going to illustrate your life that shows up
yes,
in the book.
Yes, that's one, so, of them, one of them is in there.
Yeah, uh-huh. And then a wonderful scene it's actually about a scare you had with polio at about age 4 with your natural father and mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be false, but you said, I used to have this wonderful dream right after that point called the alligator dream. What was mm-hmm. the alligator dream?
That part wasn't so, I was taken, and this was a recurring dream about going to the river as a small child with a water jar to get water, and an alligator or crocodile comes out and takes me down.
But was it a frightening dream, or?
It was, and then sometimes I would find myself in another world. You know, there is a world down there, and they have their own society.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, interesting, because even though they're taking you, they might take you for food, but they might also, you know, they pick you out.
Hmm. How much significance do you relate to your dreams, just in 21st century America? How much importance do you play to your dreams?
I put a lot of importance there, because once you study them and you pay attention to anything, it's going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever, if it's a negative thought, and you grow all kinds of nasty stuff. But the dreams, that, you know, I find all kinds of material, and they give you warnings, they give you ideas, you know, you can speak to people who've gone on. I had my Aunt Lois come to me right after she passed. She was really upset about what had been done with something that they were hiding and so on. And some of them were, well, I ate too much pizza dreams. You know, some of them you're just going, flipping through, cataloging, you know, emotional, you know, the emotional residue of the day. And then others, you know, they're very telling. And some of them are like beyond. Some of them, I was writing a note on Facebook that I used to give flying lessons in my dreams for people who wanted to fly. And some of them are other times and other, you know, I get to travel. I remember, this was in the book too, is when I was a little kid, I would lay down and my spirit would lift out of my body, and that was a relief. And so then I would go flying, and I remember lifting up, and I lived over by Admiral and 71st, you know, and having these experiences and coming up out of my body and seeing my little body there as a little kid and just saying, okay, you know, I'm free, and flying into other places and times.
By the time you reached your teenage years, you talk about the profound dread you had around your stepfather, but eventually it reached a breaking point where he wanted, I guess, the kids out of the house. He'd been abusing his mother. He abused you guys any chance you were around to be abused.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had this saving situation. They were going to send you to Indian school, probably Chiloco or Chiloco.
I wanted to go, and that's what saved me. I went to school and saw something on Indian boarding school, and I came home to my mother. And they were going to send me to Chiloco.
Uh-huh.
And then as we were leaving the BIA office, my mother said, but she's a good artist, and said, oh, well, we have this school in Santa Fe. And that was perfect. That's what started to turn my life around.
And that was the Institute of American Indian Art in Santa Fe, which had done this complete 180-degree reversal from being the typical Indian boarding school with the horror stories to this really amazing place with Fritz Schulder and Louis Ballard and all these incredible artists who were devoted to teaching a new... I would imagine there's untold Indian artists today out of that school from just having those associations with people like that. Louis Ballard was a great mentor to you.
He was, even up until right before he passed.
And this is composer, a Cherokee Quapaw composer. Had, you know, interesting relationship with Tulsa. The symphony would do some of his works, and they're really, really interesting pieces. And he was a mentor and just basically encouraged you, whatever, saxophone, whatever, you know, whatever music you like. It was a great relationship, it sounded like.
Yeah, but not at Indian school. He was just my advisor. I wasn't into music then because I had given it up. I walked away, and it wasn't until I was almost 40 that I started doing music.
And he was an encouraging there.
Yeah, we kept a friendship. I would see him at different events. But one of the last things he said to me, he said, you're going to do great things. And he said, you know, he was always very encouraging. And it's good to have people like that. You know, people who are there, they're like, you know, the post, the foundation. And even if they're not there physically, you know, they're there and they're committed and they believe in you.
And it seems like there were a lot of people that believed in all the kids there, pretty much.
There were, and, you know, and there still are. I'm actually an unofficial, a sponsor of the new class at the Institute of American Indian Arts.
Uh-huh.
I said, I want to be their sponsor. They brought me in. I went in and spoke at the opening event for their class.
So at that point, you were mainly visual art?
Yes, at that point, I was painting and drawing. And
you were attracted by poetry. You relate a horrible story about... You were very much into poetry. In fact, you said one of your most prized possessions as a young child was the Golden Book Family Treasury of Poetry.
Uh-huh.
And you were a writer. I mean, you were doing a lot of writing, and then your stepfather...
I wrote in a little journal, but it wasn't like writing. It was just like, this is what I did today. You know, I never saw myself as a writer. It wasn't until, you know, I went to the University of New Mexico, but I loved poetry. I loved reading poetry. And then I would write, you know, stupid kid stuff in a little journal, but still a diary. Still it's yours, you know, it's your private place. A diary is your own private place. And my stepfather found it. And So that means he must have been looking for it and looking through my things and found it and then had opened it up by breaking the lock and was reading from it and laughing. And that was the end of that, I thought.
I'll never write anything ever again.
Yeah.
But were you starting to write poetry when you were at the Institute? No, it was just all about art at that point.
At the Institute, actually, what happened, I did write some songs, and Dan Domingo was in that band, the artist Dan Domingo, and I saw him at his show at Indian Market, and he says, you know, we should have done something. I remember you bringing some of your lyrics over, because I started writing song lyrics, and I wanted them to do something, and I had totally forgotten he was part of that, and he says, we should have done something with that. But it wasn't, I got into the drama and dance, the drama program, and I wound up one of only two high school students in a postgraduate drama show that we took on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I wound up with one of the leads in one of the plays.
But that was a place where, compared to what you'd had, it was a place where you had people who cared about the work, and more importantly, cared enough to allow you to screw up and you know, do the normal parent thing, which, okay, you screwed up, don't screw up anymore.
Right.
That sort of thing, which was, that had been an alien force in your life, I think, prior to that.
Yeah, it had been. I mean, we were in prison. We were in prison there. And now with the insight, I mean, I can see, well, I feel my stepfather was in prison more than anybody.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. My guest today is Joy Harjo. Her memoir is titled Crazy Brave. It's published by Norton, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Tremendous musician, artist, writer, and poet. And the second half of the book talks about life after that institute, and you found love,
well,
found children.
I found children.
Well, maybe you found passion. But you found you had children very soon, and so all of a sudden, it was tough. It was, you know, you had a tough life, Tahlequah. But there was a wonderful poem that you write, and it's this is where the memoir leaves off in many senses. It's you use these four directions. You know, east is the beginning, north is where you learn difficult lessons, west is endings, and that was the ending of that sort of that period that we've been talking about, and south is the release, and it was the release from fear. And you wrote a wonderful poem that's a part of that. Would you be willing to read that to us and sort of explain the story behind it?
Sure. Yeah, I would never have guessed that I would start writing poetry. I mean, growing up in Tulsa, I didn't have, you know, I knew that people could work at American Airlines. And I knew that people worked as waitresses. And I think the biggest avocation for girls my age was people would get bride dolls, which horrified me. But as for being a poet, you know, we didn't have poets, and except the singers. I mean, I came to poetry. People, I think, you know, that's my first love. And I said, but no, it's music. I came to music, and poetry came to me together.
How much did your, before you read that poem, how much do you think your mother's, she wrote songs?
Yeah, she did.
She sang all the time. Really, how much did that have an influence on you?
I think it had a great influence on me.
Mm-hmm. And, even though it stopped at a pretty young age, you know, where that stepfather wouldn't allow her to sing anymore.
Yeah, it did. But then you always have that memory of music, and it was there, you know, it was there even before I was born. I mean, she was singing, and everything goes into that forming child, you know, that spirit. That's how, you know, you're growing the body, but you're also growing the spirit of that child.
So you have the poem here. This is about fear. Can you tell us what you were relating at the time when you were thinking about writing this poem, and what was going on in your life?
Well, I was a student at the University of New Mexico, and I was going through, I think it was, actually, I think I had a breakdown, but I didn't have the luxury of a breakdown. Because if I had a breakdown, what would happen to my children? There was no one there who would take care of them, who could take care of them.
The wards of the state, yeah.
Yeah, and I would not, you know, my mother, at that time, I had been banished from home.
Because you harbored your youngest brother, who they had thrown out of the house.
Yeah, for nothing, for being, for living, for breathing. But there was a moment in all of this that it was really coming to a head, and at one point I was battling, and, you know, And then I had a dream and where I'd faced this monster that had been chasing me for years. And I was able to, it lost any power over me, and this poem came out of that. I release you, my beautiful and terrible fear, I release you. You were my beloved and hated twin, but now I don't know you as myself. I release you with all the pain I would know with the death of my children. You are not my blood anymore. I give you back to the soldiers who burned down my home, beheaded my children, raped and sodomized my brothers and sisters. I give you back to those who stole the food from our plates when we were starving. I release you, fear, because you hold these scenes in front of me, and I was born with eyes that can never close. I release you. I release you. I release you. I release you. I am not afraid to be angry. I am not afraid to rejoice. I am not afraid to be black. I am not afraid to be white. I am not afraid to be hungry. I am not afraid to be full. I am not afraid to be hated. I am not afraid to be loved, to be loved, to be loved, fear. Oh, you have choked me, but I gave you the leash. You have gutted me, but I gave you the knife. You have devoured me, but I laid myself across the fire. I take myself back, fear. You are not my shadow any longer. I won't hold you in my hands. You can't live in my eyes, my ears, my voice, my belly, or in my heart. My heart, my heart, my heart, my heart. But come here, fear. I am alive, and you are so afraid of dying.
That's a marvelous poem. And that's where you leave off in this memoir.
And that's why I fought it for 14 years, because I wanted to start at that point.
Well, now that you've got to this, you've gotten the hard part done, do you think you'll come back to your life at some point down the road?
I think I probably will, but as I was saying when I was on book tour, and I say, I just had this baby, you know. Don't ask somebody when they're having their next baby and when they've just given birth.
And it's been a long, long labor, hasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, and this was a very long labor.
Well, Joy Harjo, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. This has been great.
Poet and musician Joy Harjo speaking with us back in 2012 upon the publication of her memoir, Crazy Brave. Yesterday, the Library of Congress named Harjo as the United States' 23rd Poet Laureate. A member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, Harjo will be the first Native American and the first Oklahoman to serve as Poet Laureate when she begins this coming fall. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.